Welcome, everyone, to today's media teleconference looking at distress in the retail sector. The simultaneous trends of consumers cutting back on spending and credit markets tightening are intensifying the financial distress for many retailers. While seven large retail companies filed for bankruptcy throughout 2007, 16 large retailers have already filed for bankruptcy since the beginning of 2008. A panel of experts specializing in retail company bankruptcies will discuss the current problems in this sector, as well as the financial future of the retail industry. The program will consist of about 30 minutes of opening commentary by our experts, and then we will take your questions. Our speakers include Laura Davis-Jones, a managing partner of the Delaware office of Pachulski, Stang, Zeal & Jones; Scott Avila, a managing partner with Corporate Revitalization Partners; and Howard Brownstein, a principal of Nachman Hayes Brownstein Incorporated. Our moderator for the program will be Professor Jack Williams, ABI's resident scholar. Professor Williams teaches an assortment of bankruptcy courses at Georgia State University College of Law. I'll now turn it over to our moderator for the program, Professor Jack Williams.
Thank you very much, John, and thank you all for tuning in today. As John mentioned, we have a wonderful panel to discuss a number of issues in the retail sector. We've got only about 30 minutes to do that. So what I'd like to do now is turn it over to Scott for an introduction of the topic today, and with a particular emphasis on the market and the economic background and current state of affairs in the retail sector. Scott?
Hi, thanks. I appreciate the time today, and thanks for everybody for joining. I'm just going to go over a couple things here. It's really kind of what happened prior to, say, 2008, what's the current state look like, and some of the impacts and sectors that are really being impacted by this. And so prior to basically Q3 of 07, we saw three things going on. Number one, it was a very robust economy. Two, the financial markets were strong. And three, there was part of that, there was low cost of capital. On the economic side, you saw really low employment, strong housing, not only in just construction, remodels, but just general sale activity. With the financial markets, it was abundant liquidity, it was low cost. The retailers were able to benefit two ways. One is the consumers had access to cheap capital through whether it was home equity loans, low interest rates. And secondly, the retailers themselves to finance their goods and support their real estate and expansion growth. Again, the low cost of capital benefited everybody here. And that went up to about Q3. And subsequent to that, what you saw was a few things happen in Q3 2007, which is really that whole process led to overexpansion due to unprecedented liquidity and strong consumer demand up until that time. You just saw a lot of new locations going up, new malls being built, new locations, and many new entrants to the retail market. If you walk around in most of the malls, they say many new jean stores and things of that nature you didn't see before. From the retailer standpoint, you also saw very highly leveraged balance sheets. They were being able to put on a lot of debt and a lot of creative debt, whether it's a first lien or second lien debt. They were able to go much deeper into the debt streams than you were seeing in the past. And today, when we fast forward to where we look at in 2008, really is what I call this trifecta approach to the retailers. You have three things that are really significantly impacting the retailers today. One is a general economic slowdown. Third is the housing industry. And then the fourth really is the scarce capital. So you have really three issues, the economics, the housing, and capital. And I'll touch on these for a moment. In the economic slowdown, you're seeing just rising commodity prices that have really impacted the consumer and led to a lot less discretionary dollars than they had in the past. You know, with their real wages falling due to wages not as increasing as fast as commodity prices, that's impacted it. On top of that, you have higher unemployment, and thirdly, you're really seeing a consumer sentiment is really starting to impact the retailers today. The real estate again, side has impacted folks twice, because not only is the housing driven slowed down significantly, but anybody who is buying a home generally has spent a lot in the retail environment. And thirdly, the real estate values to support the balance sheet and the expansion, they're not able to get that capital they had in the past. And then the scarce capital, again, is the second impact, is because consumers, now the cost for them has gone up. And without able to attack those home equity loans they had in the past, you'll see really a slowdown in any discretionary spending. If you see certain sectors like, I keep saying, ATVs, big screen TVs, motorcycles, anything that someone would take out of their home equity loan and go buy, they've been dramatically impacted. And you're seeing that across many, many retailers. So if we, kind of the overall impact is on retailers, the number of poor performing stores has really increased. On top of that, you've seen a very leveraged balance sheet so that they don't have a lot of space on a financial standpoint to continue, and so you see more and more filings. What you're seeing in what sectors is you're seeing in the middle and lower demographics are really impacted much stronger, especially in the areas of casual dining, fashion, furniture, home goods. Certain sectors are being impacted more than others. You're seeing things in the purchases can be delayed. They're going to be delayed. Destinations, if you have to travel to a retailer, those are impacted significantly. Because of the gas prices, were not willing to spend the money to drive just to pick up one item. You're seeing consumers go down market significantly. They have in the past, and we'll get to some sectors in a moment, and you can see that. And probably lastly is the management teams of these organizations are wild and varied from a skill set and their ability and capability standpoint. So certainly retailers that are able to separate themselves are doing really well. On the sector side, what certain sectors you're seeing that we're seeing that really hurt hard are obviously specialty retail, just been a significant growth in that space, and there's a lot of cannibalization going on, so they're impacted a lot. Obviously, anything to do with home goods, so Lowe's and the Home Depots and anything that someone would go and buy. Department stores are significantly impacted. The higher-end locations seem to be doing very well in the market. But as you see people shift down market due to the economic change, the discount stores are performing much better. So the Costco and the Sam's Clubs and the Walmart are doing really well. So I think you've seen in kind of in summary the significant growth in liquidity and the significant growth in the retailers up until 2007 and an overexpansion due to the abundant liquidity. The strong economic has turned to where now you're seeing a slowdown in the economy, reduction in consumer spending, and coupled with higher leveraged balance sheets is much more distressed retailers than we've seen in the past. Jack, that kind of sums up the time I was allotted here.
Sure, fantastic. That was great. If I could just summarize for you, it looks like a primary driver to a number of the financial distress in the retail sector isn't necessarily bankruptcy law or amendments per se, but just the market and the economic issues in which retail sector is operating. Laura and Howard, do you have any comments on just the economic frame of reference here before we move to the bankruptcy code and its influence and impact?
Really only to agree, and there's, Jack, I'm going to let Howard jump in, and then I might be able to move ahead and talk about some of these market changes, how it's affected actual restructuring cases that we're seeing. But definitely agreeing with Scott that the stress that the market has now put on these retailers has caused a lot of variance in now what we see in restructurings now versus even 2 years ago. And Howard, I don't know if you have any general comments on that before I kind of jump into some specifics on both how the market has changed what we see in the restructurings, but then I also do have some thoughts on how the bankruptcy code has changed some of what we see in the retail restructurings as well.
Let me make a few comments about just the business environment before we get into the cases. I read a report today that was called the American Shopperscape 2008 report, which is put out by a publication called TNS Retail Forward. And this was a survey of people's shopping patterns, basically that shoppers are trading down, shopping at fewer stores and closer to home. It reported that in their survey, 75% are planning their errands more to minimize the amount they have to drive, and more are going to one-stop shopping stores. More are going to stores that are closer to home or work, and more are doing stuff around the house anyway. But one of the most interesting statistics was that a fourth of the people are doing more online shopping. And so to me, the current climate, gasoline, et cetera, could be the catalyst that really shifts more people from bricks to clicks. And it'll be very interesting to see, even if overall spending is down, if the mix within what spending there is shifts more to online spending. This could be what it takes. That was the only general comment about the consumer part of the market I wanted to comment on. The other comment I would make is that everybody knows the retail industry is a very seasonal industry. If it weren't for back to school and Santa Claus, there might not be a retail industry. So that's to say, from a turnaround professional's point of view, which is what I am, retail businesses are lumpy. They're not spread evenly throughout the year. They have big peaks and valleys of their need for capital, working capital especially. And so, you know, they need a way to bridge the gap between when they have to put out money to order the goods and get the goods on the shelves, because you can't sell what you don't have on the shelf, and then when they actually see what they sell and get the money in and make deals with their suppliers if they need to. And that's a several-month gap, and that gap is a nervous time for everybody, especially the providers of capital. So those are my comments about the general economic climate.
Yeah, and just to pick up on something that Scott and Howard both said in terms of what's happening in the market itself demographically, I was contacted maybe a month ago from a large retailer who works or provides products in the way of soaps and lotions and things like that, and something I hadn't even really thought of. Their average price point of something coming in, they spend about $25. And the average income of someone coming into that store, a total family income, was somewhere between $50,000 and $75,000. And they said that their sales, now it isn't that they're just trending down, they have stopped. And they said that $25 that folks would have come in and spend on bath and beauty products is now just the $25 they're putting in their SUV for gas. And that they're starting to store away for their winter heating bills. And it's one of those, and Howard and Scott can have a lot of thought on this, it's very difficult to now start thinking about a business plan or a restructuring plan when you have an entity whose revenues haven't just started to shrink, they're just stopping, and it's very difficult. Jack, if you want, I can pick up a few points on how these market changes have affected the bankruptcy restructurings we're seeing.
Yeah, Laura, that'd be a great idea.
Okay. In the Scott was talking about the what I would refer to as a saturation in the market of a lease and lease space. I mean, there's just so much space available. And one of the primary areas that it's impacting our ability to be able to restructure retailers is oftentimes you put a company into bankruptcy saying that you're going to rid yourself of the different premises and locations that are losing money. You try to cut deals and better your terms with your landlord, but if you can't, you get rid of those. And you also hear people say that they get rid of the locations that are on the bubble. They're not quite losing a lot of money, but they're not making any money, and so you get rid of those as well. What's difficult now is there's no interest in the lease space. And I don't know the precise numbers, but I can tell you, for example, in Linens and Things, which just had an auction about 6 weeks ago for some of its lease space, they had 85 leases that they wanted to sell, and they had interest in five of them. You take 2 years ago, even 2.5 years ago, there would have been interest in all 85 of the spaces, and there would have been some serious bidding on a good number of the space. The same is true. It's affecting what we refer to as designation rights. And I think most people are familiar with the concept that parties come in and buy the option, if you will, buy the time to decide whether to have a debtor assume and assign a lease to them. And if they decide not to at the end of the day, they just direct the debtor to reject the lease. But what I'm finding in a lot of our retail cases is there's just no interest in buying the designation rights because there's so much other space that's out there that's available. You don't need to spend money to preserve the option to be able to try to get some space. I'll give you a real-life example. I represented G&G Retail in the Southern District of New York in January of 2006 going forward, and they were the owners of the Rave apparel stores. We had approximately 350 stores. Approximately about 500 stores in total, and we had a potential buyer in Wet Seal to take the space, and we put it out for bid, let other parties be interested in it, and a number of parties came in, and Max Azara came in and said, I want all of the stores, I'll take 350 of them right away, and I want designation rights with respect to another 150. And then there were other parties that tried to bid against Max Azara. So, and Max probably, in the end of the day, looking back, probably overpaid for the rights, and also for the space. But it was a footprint he wanted. They were located in malls throughout the country, and it was typical of retailers who would try to glom on to space that the other competing retailers had that they now have an interest in. In representing the retailers we have now, there's just not that level of interest, and it makes it very difficult to do a retail restructuring. Another market-based influence on the restructurings that's become a problem is, and Scott spoke to this, and I'm sure could speak more to it, is the real tightening on capital or being able to get any financing. The asset-based lending starting to dry up for retailers, and what there is extremely expensive. I think I saw an article the other day that it's now LIBOR plus 225 or to 275. It's very expensive borrowing, and also the what is considered an eligible receivable or eligible inventory to borrow against is also diminishing, and so because there's that lack of money, there's lack of money to do capital expenditures at these various locations. And one of the things I think most people are aware of is Bennigan's, for example, a casual retail dining chain. Decided not to even do a Chapter 11, but went straight to Chapter 7, didn't even pass go. And one of the key elements in that decision was that so many of the properties needed capital expenditure improvements, and there just wasn't the money to do it. So those are two examples of things you're seeing where the market is really impacting what can happen in a restructuring. And then the last point I'll make on what the market effect is having is when you can get lending and there is somebody that either wants to buy the retail or otherwise restructure it, the speed at which it needs to be done now is so much faster. The lenders are putting very, very tight controls on how quickly they want a bankruptcy to happen, and whether it's a sale under 363 or an internal restructuring. And there's very tight timelines and very tight milestones put into place to keep total governance on the process, where it used to be a much looser even a year and a half ago. Howard, I don't know if you have any other market-type impacts that you're seeing on the restructurings.
Well, what we're seeing is that lenders are, no big surprise, are moving the goalposts. What was an okay credit, a year ago or even several months ago is not an okay credit today. Drilling down, how that manifests itself is how they value collateral. In the retail industry, lending takes primarily two forms. First, it's the credit that the retailers get from their suppliers. It's open account credit from their suppliers, but what's behind that is something called factoring, and I'm going to assume the folks on the call know what that is, but if you don't, ask during the Q&A. And so really the retailers' financial well-being is heavily impacted by the willingness of factors to provide credit to the suppliers to those retailers. If the retailers can't get trade credit, they're dead. And the factors have all been pulling back their horns because they don't want to get stuck when a retailer files bankruptcy and can't pay the supplier. The asset-based lenders who lend to the retailers have been pulling back in a number of ways. First of all, there was a trend towards lending on the brand name, that the brand name had intellectual property value, and that the thought was that if this company gets into problems, the brand name of the store, not the brand name on the goods, would be worth something. I think that has proved to be somewhat illusory concept, and so lenders are less willing than they were to ascribe a lot of value to that. On the hard collateral, the receivables, which retailers really don't have any, all they have are credit card receivables. Not many retailers run their own open account to consumers anymore. A lot of them are really like GE Capital or somebody in disguise. But really, it's the inventory. And so what's the inventory worth, and what can the lender get for it if the lender has to liquidate? Lenders' view of that, their expansiveness, is gone, and they're much tougher in terms of what value they'll attribute to the retailer's inventory. And to the extent the retailer owns any of their real estate, needless to say, in this real estate climate, lenders are unwilling to attribute as much value to the retailer's real estate. So the lending climate has gotten very tough for retailers and for the suppliers to retailers, which also impacts the retailers themselves.
Howard, just to add to that, you're seeing the factors really clamp down on the suppliers, and I'm involved in three or four of them, and you're seeing that the factors are driving the liquidity markets because they don't have faith, and there's a lot of reservation about the holiday season coming up, and there's a lot of people looking and waiting to see how those orders start to flow through and to sell through. They're supporting manufacturers and to the retailers that have the systems and the processes to and the management teams that have been successful in these kind of downturns. But I agree with everything everybody said. It's the price. It's gone from, used to be, you know, in all fairness, closing a loan, it used to be a point in LIBOR plus two, and now it's 2 points in LIBOR plus three, and that's just the pricing. But then the actual participants in the number of lenders, the sheer number of lenders lending to the retail environment has dramatically decreased over the last 2 years. There's just not many parties in the game.
And I think the you know, assuming you could get past the market issues on a restructuring, there are a couple bankruptcy issues that have impacted the restructurings, but frankly, I think they're the tail wagging the dog because you really need to get past these market issues, which I know we've all painted kind of a doom and gloom scenario here, but there are a number of retailers that are going to make it, and mainly they're going to make it through sales to other healthier entities. But a couple of the bankruptcy impacts that you all may have heard about through BAP CPA, the 2005 amendments to the bankruptcy code that have made the retailer restructurings a little more difficult, are one, the section called 503B9, which gives any supplier or anybody who delivers goods within 20 days of a bankruptcy filing, they get an administrative claim. They get a right to 100 cents on a dollar. That makes it a very different ballgame when you're trying to emerge from Chapter 11 and do a plan of restructuring or a plan of liquidation, because you have to pay those folks 100 cents. Well, we all know in the retail industry, especially whether it's casual dining or some of the other faster-turning retailers that Scott spoke about, there's going to be a lot delivered in the 20 days before bankruptcy filing, food or what have you. And to know that you have to pay all of those vendors 100 cents on a dollar that delivered during the 20 days before the filing could be a huge nut that has to be thought through when you're trying to emerge from the Chapter 11. The other bankruptcy change that came in the 2005 amendments that people talk about a lot, but frankly, my practical experience has been that it has not made too much difference, is that the bankruptcy code now limits the amount of time that a retailer or a debtor has to decide to assume or reject a lease. It's now 120 days plus 90 days, so a total of 210 days, unless you have consent from a landlord to extend it further. Frankly, it is a practical matter, because the capital restraints are so tight. Most retailers filing have to figure out what they're doing within 210 days in any event. If we were in a market where there was a lot more available capital, I think that would be more of an issue. But the ones that I've been representing since the amendments have come out, things are moving so quickly and have to move so quickly because of their capital constraints that we've been able to work with that 210 days. And where we were able to get consent of the landlord because for things like Howard and Scott were saying, you know, people want storage stores open through the holiday or what have you. So those are kind of the two big bankruptcy issues that I think get involved in these retailer restructurings, among some others. But I think the market-driven factors are much more dispositive of what you're going to see happening in the retail industry.
This is Howard Brownstein. Let me just make a quick comment. You know, there's no doubt that the change in the bankruptcy code affects, you know, how these cases proceed and are managed. But it really doesn't change the underlying facts. The underlying facts are that everybody, the creditors, the landlords, the banks, the factors, are all looking at the same thing, which is what is the success or chance for success of the underlying business. Without this, there's not a whole lot to talk about. And so all these changes in the rules do is affect who's got the power to do what when, but it doesn't change the underlying reality. And so in a case where a restructuring is possible, all some of these changes in deadlines do is force the parties to plan a little better, get out in front of the problem more. People like me might be involved in talking to landlords even ahead of a filing, because the landlord doesn't want the empty space either. And it's not like they have a lot of other stores lined up to take the space. So in this climate, they may be more inclined to be flexible, both as to deadlines and as to terms. The real question is there a pony under the pile? Is there a business there that can make it, and what will it take?
I think, Howard, this is Scott Abel. I think what you just said is really the key. What you're seeing now in the restructuring is, if you don't bring to the table sooner a what I'll call a consensual understanding of the underlying economics. Is this business really here? And is it going to survive in the current economic conditions? I've seen situations where they're trading down on the comp store basis, you know, double digits. And the questions everybody's asking themselves is, for how long is this thing going to trade down? Is this location? And I think, as you said earlier, Laura, these bubble locations in the past might have been good, but you're seeing them cut deeper stores sooner. In situations I've been in with Movie Gallery and others, you just had to cut a lot deeper and sooner. And then secondly, is there really a business, as you say, around some core group of stores that can weather the storm? And then B is, you better have gone out beforehand with your senior lenders, with your, you know, subordinated lenders, if that you have any, as well as with your landlord. But it's all based on a strong business model that's defensible and is going to survive in the current economic conditions.
And then Howard, I've got a question for you. We're slowly starting to, unfortunately, run out of time, but. What do you think, from your perspective, the future of this sector is going to look like? If I ask you to pull out your crystal ball, what are we going to be? Are we going to be talking about the retail sector a year from now? What are some of the problems that may percolate between now and then? And what do you see as the future for this particular sector?
I think things are going to change fundamentally. I think that we feel like you dropped a pebble in a well to hear how deep it is, and you haven't heard it hit bottom yet. I think we haven't really seen the impact in our economy of it costing $50 and $60 to fill up your tank with gas. And it's going to ripple through the economy in so many ways. I mean, look at all the industries that depend on retailing, shipping companies and delivery companies and people that do all the cleaning at the malls and everything. I think that this is going to have a huge effect, and I don't think even with a recovering economy, which we all hope and pray there will be, I don't think it will ever get the genie back in the bottle. I think memories will stick. So I think we're going to see a fundamental shift in the retailing industry, and I think there'll have to be some fundamental structural changes in how space gets used. In our belief, you know, the retailing industry is really just is really just real estate in disguise. You're just selling real estate by the shelf foot. And so you've got to have something that makes that shelf foot valuable, or it becomes less valuable. You know, over 200 years ago, or not quite, maybe 150 years ago, David Ricardo said that, you know, corn wasn't expensive because land is expensive. Land is valuable if you can sell corn. So really, all the real estate value is what can you use it for? And if you can't sell luxury goods at high margins, and you can't sell normal staples at decent margins, then the real estate is less valuable. That means the bank's collateral is less valuable. That means the bank's capital is impaired. This is going to be a process, folks. And we're seeing it in the retail because that's where it hits consumers first, but the ripples haven't really been felt yet.
That's interesting. Scott, what about your take on the future of the sector?
Well, two takes. Number one is I agree with Howard. There is a fundamental change, and I agree with the real estate concept. Everybody talks about the Internet, and I think you're going to see a shift to there's products that work well on the Internet and others that don't, and that's going to really be affected by the touch and feel of the products and the ability to continue to do that touch and feel. You haven't seen the huge slowdown people expected, even though retail has grown. You're seeing the destination issue, as we mentioned earlier, about the $60 gas. If I need to buy a gadget and I look at myself and I need to drive 25 miles, you know, or 30 miles round trip to buy it, and I can easily just get online and buy it, and the touch and feel doesn't matter. Those are the type of products, and you're going to see that through the retails and how they floor plan, how they plan their locations, how they plan their seasonal aspects. You're going to see more and more of that change to where consumers are going to shift their buying patterns, and the retailers that are on top of the ball are going to see that. I think you're going to see changes in the sales tax because the sales tax issues for malls and retailers is starting to be impactful, and your local states and governments and counties are impacting that by they're not getting that sales tax revenue from online, and I think you're going to see a change in legislation for that because there's a lot of pressure from malls and retailers and their lobbying efforts to drive that change because they want to compete on a fair basis, and you're going to see the local government standing up for that. I think the last thing is the customer experience. The customer experience needs to go, be a much greater expense. I mean, I know I went to a Home Depot the other day, and you could walk in and out and not talk to a soul except the guy at the store who hands you your receipt and make sure you've got the right stuff in the bag, and you can easily confuse him for the valet. So I think those three issues is the Internet, the touch and feel, and actually service concept is going to be impactful.
Laura, last but not least, from your perspective, what do you see developing in the future in the retail sector?
Well, I think from a bankruptcy lawyer's restructuring perspective, and maybe I'm just taking it just a step further down the road from what Howard and Scott say, I think you're going to see a lot more in the near future of companies doing what Bennigan's did, decide not to pass go, just go directly to Chapter 7 because of the costs involved and the liquidity restraints and the practical realities of whether they're really going to be able to restructure because is there going to be anybody interested in their leases that they need to get rid of and so forth. I think a lot will be telling on what happens after this coming holiday season. I think this holiday is going to be very important for the retailers, and my guess is what you'll see on the other side is more consolidation. Only the bigger, stronger ones will survive. And some of the more regional chains, I think we'll see them some more filings after the beginning of the year, and then hopefully it settles out by summertime. But I think the settling out will end up in being fewer choices for the consumer. Frankly, probably fewer choices of bigger entities, and just the stronger ones that, as Howard would say, were able to weather the storm will be standing around and be available for the next holiday season. But I think this holiday season is going to weed out some of quite a bit of the less strong entities.
That's very interesting, Scott, Laura, and Howard. I want to thank you on behalf of the ABI for your comments. It's been fascinating today. Chad, at this time, we're ready for any questions.
Thank you. The question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you would like to ask a question, please do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touchtone telephone. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure the mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, press star 1 to ask a question, and we'll pause for just a moment. And no questions at this time. However, as a reminder, star 1 for questions.
All right, then. Well, John, if there's no objection, I think we can maybe wait another minute to see if there are any questions. If not, I think we can call this conference presentation over.
Agreed, Jack. And if there's any additional commentary from our speakers, if there's any points that additional points you'd like to touch on while folks are dialing in with questions, if you'd like to touch on those now, please feel free.
And once again, star 1 if you do have a question.
This is Howard Brownstein. That's awfully dangerous telling me that there's time for me to talk. Let me just add a quick comment or two that, that one thing we're seeing is that landlords are being flexible, for example, as to the use restrictions that they might have in their leases, and more willing to let either a new tenant coming in or an existing tenant trying to restructure vary from, you know, some of the rules that affected the use of the property in the past. And again, it's a recognition that the economic realities trump what's in a contract, that while the contract may say one thing and the bankruptcy code may have stiffened up an ability of the landlord to get such restrictions and keep them even in a bankruptcy, the fact that remains that if the landlord wants to rent the space, they're going to have to meet the market. And if the market is that this is the tenant who's available and this is how he wants to use the space, the landlord's going to have to accept that or have empty space. So I think that's important. A big question in people's minds has to do with luxury goods and branded goods. In past softenings of the consumer economy, luxury goods have held up and have been a safe bet. There's been a kind of a flight to quality. People with money would buy the high price spread. We're seeing some real cracks in that facade. We're seeing luxury goods not nearly as lustrous as they were, and even people with money to spend not being as quick or willing to spend it on luxury goods. I think we've seen some kind of over-branding. Everybody has a brand. Everybody wants a brand. Brands are merged and married together in the marketing of a product. I think we're going to see eventually some pulling back on that. I think that brand recognition is a good thing, but it's not an infinite thing. And I think we're going to see some pulling back on that because people are just going to have to stretch their dollars and they're going to become less concerned with, you know, whose name is on the product. So it's going to be quite a ride. And we don't see a lot of relief from this through, I would say, back to school season next year. And it's a question in everybody's mind what Christmas 2009 will be like. Christmas 2008 is not going to be a happy time, I think, regardless of the outcome of the election, by the way.
Chad, do you have any indication of questions in the queue?
And we do have a question from Brent Feltner with Reed Business Information.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you.
And please go ahead, sir.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes, hi. Your comments have been very helpful today, and it seems, from my observations, even the typical distressed debt players are much less involved today than they have been in the last few years. I wonder if you could just spend a minute talking about how many of these 11s will likely convert and how many of them you see will be good candidates to emerge, given the context of the current environment.
This is Laura. I guess I'll start off on that one. I think of the bankruptcy cases that are already queued up, the ones that are already in the bankruptcy court and under bankruptcy protection. Just from what I know and who's involved out there, I think you're talking about 60 to 70% of them will successfully emerge because they're far enough down the road with lenders that are committed, and I think they will make their emergence. Now, remember, for most of them, these are liquidating 11s. They are not internal restructurings. So, you know, they're either being sold in bits and pieces or sold to another entity. But having said that, unlike where we would have been 2-3 years ago, there's still, I think, the potential of the 30 to 40% that are in the queue or that are already in the bankruptcy that won't make it, despite them being liquidating cases, because there's just not enough interest in what it is that they're liquidating, and the lenders are just not willing to stand by and wait for it. In terms of ones that we know that are in the channel that have not yet filed, or ones that we think will file come February after the end of next year, I think the chance of them being Chapter 7s versus 11 even in the first instance is much higher. And I think there will be some that will try it as an 11, but that will convert to a 7. And I think it will be at higher levels than what we would have seen previously 2-3 years ago. Howard and Scott, I don't know if you agree with that.
But I agree with you. I think the higher levels and also the size of the organization you'll see that may convert. In the past, you wouldn't see an organization of any substance convert. It would, you know, whether it's a Bennigan's or anything of that nature, because you could always peel out a core set of operations that you could, it could be profitable at some level. But I agree with you, Laura, that you're going to see conversions of the higher level of conversions.
This is Howard. I mean, I think I'd agree with the comments. I think they'll certainly be pushed to convert these. I think it's the, you know, the U.S. trustee's job any time that, you know, the weather in the room goes up or down a degree to move for conversion. I think sometimes that's just a cudgel that gets people moving and gets solutions created. But it's the rare business of any real magnitude that benefits from a Chapter 7 conversion with a panel trustee at the helm rather than a orderly liquidation run either by management or by corporate renewal professionals. There's always something worth saving as something of a going concern, or there's intellectual property that might be realized upon. There's a way to bring in special purchase goods to run orderly going out of business sales. And a lot of that is hard to do in a Chapter 7.
Fair to say that given the amount of leverage that's been out there over the last few years, that the secureds in these cases will be taking pretty good big hits in these liquidations?
When you say secured, I'm assuming you mean not just senior debt, but people who have a secured position behind what I'll call traditional banks. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean first and second tier, basically, right?
Say that again?
Basically first and second tier debt.
You will see them either being impaired or converting down to own it on a restructured basis.
And I think, and consistent with the comments we made earlier, I think you're going to see a lot less likelihood to be a new lender into the situation.
Right.
It's going to be much more difficult to find DIP financing or other ways of lending into the situation. I think you're correct that the old lenders or the old secured players will be taking severe haircuts. But the more troubling aspect is going to be that it's going to be difficult to get new money into the situation.
And if I heard you correctly earlier, you were saying pretty much that the level of patience to wait this out is going to be much less than what it's been.
That's correct, sir. I mean, there's just many more controls being put on when lending is being made. The timelines are being made much tighter, and there's just new conditions being put into the financing. One of the most recent popular things that's happening now is this concept of lease reserves that is being put into DIP financing. I've seen it probably in 3 cases now. I don't know, Howard and Scott, if you're been negotiating these yet or not, but basically this is where the lender now demands that as part of the DIP financing, there's going to be a reserve put out there or money set aside, if you will, to be able to pay the rent at the various locations should the landlord or should the lender be put in a situation where it has to go into the space and run GOB sales or what have you. So now just another new one, it's an indicia of them tightening up and getting more protections, but two, it's a new tool to do it, is this concept of lease reserves.
And last follow-up on this, will we see a reduction in the number of 363s coming out of this because of the economy? There's just not enough bidders out there to be interested.
Well, 363s are sales to bidders, so I'm not sure what the question means.
I'm sorry. Will there be fewer of them proposed?
Well, there certainly will be fewer people showing up at the auctions. And, you know, ultimately, you know, these things, if there's anything to sell, it'll sell. The question is, what's the value and how popular will it be? The values are definitely down.
Well, and I think the other thing, Howard, in connection with that is like the Bennigan situation, I think
right. You
will see more sevens without trying to do a 363 in the Chapter 11 cases.
What you also could see, though, I think, is speak to the questioner's first point, is that these second lien lenders who are below the first liens, they're going to have, if they have money in the deal. They may need to put up funds to support the business, in effect, to credit bid it to get it out. So it's a 363, but it's not really because there's no real bidders. It's kind of a one-bid show. When the individual is going to credit bid to preserve their investment, have to come out of pocket, assuming the fund has liquidity. If it doesn't, then obviously that's off the table. So when you say it's a 363, it's the emotion. But back to what Howard and Warble said, is there's really no other bidders. They're just going to convert their debt down because there's that, or they take a big haircut. So I think you're going to see that cycle continue, and we saw it last year. And candidly, a lot of cases, you're going to see more and more of that. Whether it's retail, retail is a great example of the overleverage and people coming in on a second lien basis and then converting down to equity in the 363 and just credit bidding. I mean, Laura, what do you think?
No, I agree with that.
Thank you.
Chad, do we have any more questions?
And we have one more question. We'll go to Sherry Slater from the Journal Gazette.
Hi. I will take one for the team and admit I don't know what factors are.
Okay. The actual financing called factoring goes back, I think, to the days of the Venetian merchants in the Renaissance, and basically was an invention whereby if you're a supplier to a retailer, you can get financing for yourself by, in effect, selling that account receivable owed by the retailer to a lender.
Oh, okay.
And at that point, the money is collected by that lender. There are all sorts of variations on that theme. The major one is whether there is any recourse by that lender back to you as the supplier if the retailer doesn't pay. Mm. There are other variations whereby all a factor will really provide you is credit insurance, whereby you invoice the retailer, you collect the money when the retailer pays, and if the retailer doesn't pay for certain reasons, then the factor would pay you back less a deductible. It's a big industry. There's an organization called the Commercial Finance Association out there that includes all the asset-based lenders and the factors. There are other factoring associations that mostly deal with smaller factoring companies, but it's a huge industry. And it's the way people who sell to retailers principally finance themselves.
Okay, thank you.
The reason why it's so important, and not to add a little bit, comment to that, is that you'll see in situations that a factor may represent multiple suppliers to a retailer, or vice versa, a retailer may be into a factoring on the other side to the supplier. So you will see that if you're restructuring a retailer, if there's concern about that retailer, he'll go through, a large swath of his supply chain overnight, and his credit and liquidity will dry up instantaneously.
Hmm.
So if he buys, pick the number, $100 million goods a year, you could see $50 million liquidity instead of 60-day terms go to 10-day terms overnight.
Wow. Thank you.
Chad, any more questions?
No other questions at this time.
All right. Well, thank you again to the panelists and all those who were in attendance today. On behalf of the ABI, we, again, thank you so much. It was a wonderful session and very informative. You all have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.